Good morning. We're delighted to welcome Wayland Academy students. Would they stand? Seeing you all, you may be seated. And we have Cities Project High School students. Would they stand, please? We're glad to see you too. Please be seated. Students are here with us this morning on a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. Under that program, we invite high school students to come to court. If the invitation is accepted, we send them briefs of the case that they are going to hear, and the students may engage in a number of activities related to that case. They then come to oral argument, and as part of that oral argument, they will meet with a justice of this court after this oral argument. Everyone's invited to attend that session with the justice. The discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substance of the issue. We also have summaries of the case you're about to hear. If anyone needs or would like a summary of the case because they're unfamiliar with the case, raise your hand. The marshal will distribute the summary. While the marshal is distributing the summary, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. The noon presentation will be with Justice Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. We'll now call our second case this morning, 05AP2607, Estate of James H. Madison and versus Robert R. Madison. Arguing on behalf of Robert R. Madison et al. Is attorney Stephen Morgan. Let me just go through the lineup. Then Mr. Hurtle will argue for 15 minutes on behalf of the estate, and then Mr. Posansky will argue 15 minutes on behalf of the state. Is that right? And then Mr. Morgan will do the rebuttal. Okay? All right. Mr. Morgan.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce to the court attorney and partner of mine, Jennifer Krieger, who is on brief, and also introduce Mr. Robert Mattson, who is present in the courtroom. And we thank the court for hearing this matter on a general partnership issue and on an issue for appellate practice as well, two definitely unrelated issues. And I'm going to start and probably try to devote half of my time to both of the two issues. The first one I'd like to start with is the partnership issue. We've already had, and the court is well familiar with the facts, but we've already had a divvying up of the assets to a degree here. We've had a dissolution of a two-person general partnership. And the trial court and the Court of Appeals have decided several of the important issues related to the values involved. And the one value that carries forward here is the fact that the retiring general partner's value in the partnership up to the date that he retired, which was May 31 of 2001, was approximately $68,000. The issue that we're facing now at this court level, and there's really two small parts to it that are interrelated, but there are two parts to it. The issue we're facing is when the partnership continued on after the one partner left, how, and under the statute, under Section 178.37, How is that $68,000 to be treated under that statute? I think that's the simplest way of looking at that. We have appealed, arguing that the burden of persuasion of showing the trial court how much profit is generated from that $68,000 is upon the departing partner. So far, the trial court and the Court of Appeals have not agreed with our opinion. The related question to that is, okay, we know that there's $68,000 involved. How do we determine what profits are to be derived from that? And I know that everyone looks at statutes. I look at them all the time. All practicing attorneys do, and they form the basis of our work. I think that the statute in question here, 178.37, and I would like to read it because I think it sets up some of the concepts that I'm going to address. It starts, for this issue, that a departing partner shall receive as an ordinary creditor an amount equal to the value of his interest in the dissolved partnership with interest, or at his option, the profits attributable to the use of his right in the property of the dissolved partnership. What happened here is the retired partner, who unfortunately died about 5-6 months after he retired, the estate chose to select that not for interest on the $68,000, which would have been the statutory interest rate of 5%, but rather to go with the profits attributable to the use of that $68,000. And for that, and I put this again into the spin of the argument here, it is as an ordinary creditor, not as a general partner. This is a partner who has left under Chapter 178. That partner who has left no longer is jointly and severally liable for the new bills and debts incurred by that partnership, but instead is free of those. Furthermore, the retiring partner obviously does not engage in any work, and that certainly was the case here. The retiring partner did no work.
Counselor, if Robert had just paid the $68,000, that would have been the end of the story, right?
Yes.
And the reason it wasn't paid is that that had to be a tried amount, and the court had to find what that amount was. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so there wasn't really an agreement before trial that this was owed, and they just dallied around, or maybe that's a bad choice of words. They had to continue the business with these assets because they couldn't get them unhooked fast enough. This is just an occurrence because they couldn't agree on what that dollar amount was, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Fine. Thanks. I just want to be sure I understood.
And from a time perspective, the lawsuit was filed about 10 days after James Mattson died. Mm-hmm. It was filed like on December 20 or 21 of the year 2001. Trial occurs in approximately 2004. Judgment is entered about a year later. That's the first involvement of Ms. Krieger and me into the lawsuit, was at the time the judgment was being signed. Prior to that, we had no involvement.
Counsel, can you explain to me the burden of proof and why it's on the departing partner?
It's on the departing partner, first of all, because the only cases throughout the country that have dealt with this issue, and there are three that we claim are directly on point, are Uniform Act states, say that it is on the retiring partner. There are other cases that we've included in our brief that are analogous in that they put the burden of establishing and proving an accounting on one partner who asks for an accounting. This is not a situation of an accounting, but all cases seem to put the burden on the person seeking the relief. Section 178.37 lets that retiring partner make the choice. Why should the burden from a policy standpoint be on the partnership to assume that he would want us to spend the money, he would want the existing partnership to spend money, time, and energy to calculate $68,000 is invested into the partnership, how do we calculate what the profits will be?
Council, maybe this is my problem with your argument, and you have to help me to correct my error in thinking.
I will certainly try.
Okay. You said, what could be the policy? Well, the Court of Appeals, of course, saw it differently than you did. In their policy, at the slip opinion I have here, page 10, it says, it is clear to us that the continuing partner who runs the business and has access to all of its records is the one who should have to show how profits are earned and to what they are attributable. That's paragraph 20. When I read that, I thought, well, that sounds reasonable to me. And I'll tell you, I thought to myself, it sounds reasonable to me, particularly in the situation where you have the departing partner who is now deceased. How is the estate going to prove the profits? I mean, if he were alive, he'd have maybe, you know, a knowledge. But now we're talking about the estate. And so the Court of Appeals offers the rationale that it's the continuing partner who runs the business and who has access to all of the records is the one who should show how the profits are. And I looked at the cases that were cited, and I didn't read them all carefully. I went through them in a summary fashion. I know this is probably on TV, and maybe I shouldn't say that, but I did. Anyway. The only state that has a case involving, that I saw, that has a case involving a deceased departing, I mean, a departing partner who's really departed is Texas. The other states don't have, as I saw it, the deceased component. And when I looked at the Texas cases, you're right, they placed the burden on the departed, but they do so without any analysis whatsoever. The administration of the estate of Thomas Cobble makes the assertion, but with no analysis. Paul Bader case makes the assertion and no analysis. The Cheek case, which is the one I think that you particularly make reference to, makes the assertion, but as I see it, no analysis. It says, a partner of dissolved partnership seeking to recover his proportionate share of post-dissolution profits must establish his right to profits in which he asserts an interest, you know, citing another Texas case that had no analysis. So, seems to me to make some sense that when you're dealing with a case with a deceased partner, you put the burden up like the Court of Appeals did. Address that, if you will, for me.
First of all, the statute makes no exception for an estate versus a living withdrawn partner. Secondly, general partnerships are of numerous size. I've unfortunately been involved in one where there was 1,500 general partners, if you could imagine that. That's not really a possibility, but I deal a lot in securities law, and there's a lot of odd things sold. And there are partnerships as this is, two brothers of two persons. And in this case, because all cases come to us with different facts, and I don't like to answer your question with this particular fact situation, but this is a unique fact situation. The retiring partner ran the business. The retiring partner, unannounced, retired on May 31st of 2001, unknown to Robert Mattson. And at that time, his wife likewise retired, and she was the sole bookkeeper. So now Robert Mattson is left with a brand new business because his partner had his own accounts. Robert had his accounts, but he was not the day-to-day manager. He was also a 45% partner, and the other was 55. So, in part, my answer to you is, if you have a situation like ours, it is very clear that James Mattson, when he retired, on the day he retired, he could have set this all up if that's what he wanted to do. He knew everything. Why didn't he, on May 31st, say, I'm out of here, and here's our dissolution. Here's all the numbers. Why didn't he, when he was the accountant, do all that? And from a policy standpoint, I can see your comment about the estate having some problems, but the estate is merely picking up from where James was, and James, before he passed away, had 6 months to take care of all these problems.
Okay. If he would have had 1 month, or if he would have had 5 days, it doesn't seem, maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem to me that that's of the essence, that he had 5 days or 6 months or 3 months or whatever.
Well, he knew everything.
You know, so he was dragging his feet. I mean, the guy's dead.
Then there's what can you learn from that? There's discovery.
Yeah. Litigation. The estate then has to.
That's correct. The estate
get into
filed
the books
suit.
And try to get an expert and go through the books and find out everything that's going on.
And they
on.
Can hire their own accountant. And at this point, there was. It would have been nice to see a new accountant come in, because there hadn't been any good accounting kept of these books and records. So I think that the rules of discovery answer a great deal of that issue. It should be an even plane for either the plaintiff or defendant in analyzing the books and records in saying that the $68,000, which I also wanted to add, the $68,000 as an ordinary creditor is much like a loan. It is money invested after the dissolution. And we didn't know at the time. It took until 2004 to calculate that number because of the disputes between the parties. But there was a pile of money that was invested by the departing partner. It is a loan. It's not equity. It's not like stock. It was a loan to this business. You can follow that $68,000. You can get any expert witness to say this business could or could not have survived with or without that $68,000. And because that $68,000 was present inside the business for those 3 or 4 years, here's the profits that came out of it. I don't see that as a difficult matter. I don't see either party having a positive position over the other in connection with proving the value of that $68,000 4 years later. It seems to me that it's going to require either party, both parties, to call an accountant. In this case, the court tried to do a court-appointed accountant.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. With respect to that accountant, the parties agreed to that being the figure they would use, yes?
They agreed to having an accountant do the work, yes.
Okay.
I do not think that there is any kind of an agreement as to what that accountant calculated.
Okay, so they did not stipulate to agree to the results that that accountant would reach?
No. They agreed to have a court-appointed accountant. Unfortunately, I don't think either party focused on the issues that we're focusing very intently on appeals. I think at the trial court level, the trial court worked hard to work his way through all of the accounting that was involved and come up with the numbers, and did an admirable job in the face of a fight between the parties. But the narrow issues of looking at this statute, 178.37, and looking at the last words of profits attributable to the use of the $68,000, was not really discussed. How else could the trial court have come up with what I think is an absurd result of the application, and this is the second half of the partnership issue, of the absurd result of simply saying, well, I'm going to just pull in the old percentages that they had, 55-45, which gives absolutely, from a policy perspective, no weight whatsoever to the hours spent in creating the business, to the creativity of the continuing partner in pushing that business forward.
Counselor, on this use of the accountant, did the accountant establish the value that was determined as the value on the date of dissolution?
I'm not certain that I'm answering this correctly, but they did get the $68,000.
Okay, and then did the accountant also follow what he or she determined to be the value at dissolution through the time that the business was ongoing until we had the cutoff at trial?
I think you asked. I'm going to answer it differently. The accountant determined the value of the gross profit of the business from the date of dissolution.
That's a different question than I asked.
Yes, it is. He did not determine the value of the $68,000 and 4 years later its value.
Nobody followed the money to determine what that interest would be worth during this particular time.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
I'm trying to understand what facts are accepted here. Are all parties accepting the Court of Appeals decision about how you have the valuation at the time of dissolution, and then you have certain set-offs from the profit, or how you calculate profit after dissolution? For example, the compensation to your clients. What is wrong with 5545 after you employ the scheme suggested by or directed by the Court of Appeals?
What the Court of Appeals did was send it back for determination of what was the value of the hours spent by Mr. Mattson and by his wife, who also worked in the business, and to calculate that from the gross profits, the $282,000 gross profit, to bring that down to a number, to apply those expenses to the $282,000, and then determine, okay, here is the net profit. After we get to net profit, and we do not have that number, after we get to a net profit, what will be, and it's, to me, not answered by the Court of Appeals except to apply the 5545 to that net profit. To me, that makes absolutely no policy sense because, for several reasons, because the departing partner has no risk. His $68,000 is at risk, but if there is a bill run-up of $500,000, only Robert Mattson is responsible for the $500,000, plus he still owes the $68,000. To his departing partner. Furthermore, effort.
No, wait a minute. Now, there can be no liability for the right. state's share if the partnership is still going on, if right. there are creditors?
That's correct, except for the creditors who existed prior to the date of dissolution. Under Chapter 178, upon dissolution, the departing general partner is free of obligations into the future when the business continues, except for those obligations that existed when he departed.
And that's in statute?
Yes. Yeah. In a couple of places. And I had them down on a piece of paper before I came here, and maybe Ms. Krieger can recollect them. For example, Section 178.36 paren 10. 178.36 paren 10.
But there were creditors before dissolution.
Yes.
That had to be taken into account after dissolution.
And to those creditors. Those creditors, I say that those creditors, James Mattson, would be responsible for. But we've gone on 4 years after his departure. By then, those creditors had been paid and new creditors were in place.
Now, you folks are the ones who appeal from the circuit court?
Actually, it was joint appeals. Both parties appealed, different issues.
Okay. But I mean, were you the principal appellant?
I like to think so, yes.
rephrase that
question. All right, all right. You paid money into the Fond du Lac County Clerk of Courts office.
Thank you for the transition. Yes, we did. We paid the value, the full value of the judgment, which was approximately, I don't have it exactly right, around $120,000, and we paid a full year's interest of 12% calculated on that.
Doesn't the Clerk of Court have the authority under Section 59 something or other to take the money that has been paid in and invest it, and it will go to the benefit of the county board or the county general fund unless something happens?
We obtained an order of the trial court which, at our request, the money was to be invested with any proceeds generated by that, simple interest generated by that, to be payable to Robert Mattson, so that the fund would, at the end of a year, have exactly how much it had when we put it in.
If you didn't have to pay 12%, wouldn't the interest on the money that was put into the clerk of court really belong to the estate?
Yes, if we hadn't have asked for that order. And the reason we asked for the order is because we put in not only the principal amount, but the extra 12%. If it had been done as we had asked, which was to put in the $120,000 amount of judgment, then I would agree that the estate should be getting whatever interest is generated on that. But because we had to pay 12% interest in advance for a year, the estate wasn't entitled to that.
In other words, they don't get double interest on the money.
Correct.
Gave them the flat 12%, and anything that's over that, you should get.
That's correct. That's
what
happened.
That's your theory.
That's what happened here.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
As near as I can tell from looking at the briefs, neither party has cited the case of Gull versus Van Epps, 185 West 2nd, 609, a Court of Appeals opinion. And I just wanted to ask initially, and depending upon your answer, I'll have a follow-up question, whether or not, at least from your perspective, you're satisfied that that case does not govern this fact situation or is not applicable. Is that your impression, or are you aware of the case?
I'm aware of the case. It was a breakup of a law partnership.
Right.
And I thought that the primary decision in that case was that the future legal fees generated by additional clients or even the existing clients would not be split because of the way that they had their law partnership arranged. Further, I would think that there would be some question of sharing in fees into the future of a law firm that you're not involved in.
And the reason I asked the question, I think that's an accurate statement. There's some language from that case that says we are confident from this history of involving the UPA, that it embodies the principle that a deceased or withdrawing partner has no claim to post-dissolution profits where those profits are realized from the skill and services of the remaining partners. We therefore conclude that the trial court reached the correct result. And I guess my question is, in this particular action, with respect to the profits that were ascertained by the accountant, was there any calculation done in the circuit court that separated out which profits came as a result of the activities of the surviving partner and what he put into the business versus the money that was just taken as a credit from a creditor situation that was there and how that should be?
I think the answer is there was no calculation to make that determination, none whatsoever.
Right. Thank you.
All that was calculated was the gross total, and then of that, the 55-45 was applied.
What do you want?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, did you finish?
I finished my answer, yes.
How would you want it calculated?
I want first the burden to be on the estate to establish how it views its 68,000 created profits. Second, I don't think it should be a huge windfall.
It's now what?
It should not be a huge windfall to the estate. As it's set up under the trial court's decision, the estate gets 55% of $282,000. Obviously, that will be changed because costs will be subtracted from that $282,000. But 55% of even $100,000 in profits would be $55,000, whereas a $68,000 investment at 5% interest is slightly less per year than $3,500, and in 4 years, you're under $15,000. So if the estate believes that this partnership created such profits, which we don't believe it created, I guess I don't know how, answering Justice Bradley, your questions again, I don't know how I really come with the burden of proving to the estate's satisfaction. I could never prove it to the estate's satisfaction would be a better answer to your question. I spend the energy to determine a number, and they'll say it's wrong. And is that where we end up? If I have to go through and make all those calculations, the estate will never agree, number one. Certainly nothing was agreed to in this case ever. But number two, in that matter, then they will go forward and calculate a new number and try to prove that to the court.
Okay. The test, though, is at death. At dissolution here. What you have to do is figure out the value of that departing partner's interest in the partnership.
We did at $68,000.
That's what the accountant said.
And that's now settled because nobody appealed that from the Court of Appeals.
Okay. So as of that date, which was May 31, if I remember, the departing partner's interest, his 55% interest, was worth $68,000.
Yes, as of May 31 of 2001.
And theoretically, everybody accepts that. Okay. Now, that was not paid immediately.
Correct.
And so then we have a lawsuit on it. And are we still at the value as of death, or have we come to the option part?
We are at the option part.
Okay. So now is the $68,000 still in play?
It's in play as the base amount. It would be either the base amount for the 5% interest or the base amount on which you would calculate the profits attributable to the use of the retired partner's right in the property.
Okay.
And that's the $68,000.
That's what I'm getting at. So it's as if he invested 68 grand in the partnership, which is the way you set it forth. So it's the use of his 68,000 for 5 months.
No, it would be for until it's paid.
And it still hasn't been paid.
We put the money in.
So then you would figure that when you put the money in, that ends that calculation, except interest on it. That's your view.
Yes.
Okay. And exactly where do you think the Court of Appeals went wrong?
Exactly. I think exactly was the 55-45 split. Where does that come from?
To what was it applied?
To the growth, to the profits.
Okay.
After dissolution.
Right.
And it should have been applied to the 68,000 as to what it generated for the next 4 years.
Okay. And you would write the opinion in what way? You can tell us after you come back up.
I can do that. I also wanted to point out one other thing. I think that the Court of Appeals said at paragraph 7 of its opinion that the purpose of paying an outgoing partner for profits and for interest was twofold. One, it was to compensate the partner for the past, and that is the $68,000. And two, it's a, as they quoted, a species of compulsion forcing the other partner to get going and pay it. Here, the lawsuit steps in the way, and I don't know where the species of compulsion continues when there's a lawsuit and there's substantial, as Court of Appeals noted, substantial discovery disputes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Well, could Chief,
yes, sorry. Justice Prosser.
Mr. Morgan, one other question. You said in answer to the Chief's question, my principal problem with the Court of Appeals decision is the 55-45 application to gross profit. Is that your answer?
That's the chief answer that I can give you. There is the second answer, which would be that whose burden of proving what those profits are.
Okay.
Closely related. I put them together.
I'm not surprised by your answer to the chief's question, but maybe I don't quite understand why there was not a question that really dealt with that 55-45 and as it is applied to what. It was simply a more generic question about burden of proof and then the interest afterwards. I mean, there didn't seem to be a question focused right on that point.
I think our second heading is on the 55-45 in our brief, second or third Roman numeral, I can't remember which.
It's the division of future profits after dissolution can't be based on the old formula for the division of profits among active partners. That's your second argument.
That's our second, yes. But our first was because the Court of Appeals and the trial court based its decision in going forward and calculating numbers on that we had the burden of proving, we failed to prove the burden, and therefore it was simply adopting the old 55-45.
So you ask here, I'm sorry, you've done, Justice? Go ahead.
Well, that's part of your argument. I didn't see it as a question, as a legal question or an issue posed for the court to decide.
I think that it is incumbent, or not incumbent, I think that it is part of the statute itself. How do you determine the words profits attributable to the use of the, I insert, $68,000? It should, in one sense, send it back to the trial court, tell the trial court to figure out how to calculate this. That is one answer. Your answering of that question perhaps is in the there's no facts before you to answer that. It's not a sua sponte question.
You have to be able to either apportion his $68,000 to the total assets of the partnership, and that would be net assets after paying bills. And wouldn't that keep changing as the business goes on? I mean, in the first year, it's worth 68, but maybe the next year, the percentage would be different because the other guy's assets would then be your client's assets. Roberts would be above the 45, and then they would be, you know, higher yet. So as you use this one chink of the business and the business grows, the chink gets smaller in relationship to what's left, right? Isn't that your argument, why the 55-45 doesn't fit?
No, it isn't.
Okay, what is it then?
My argument is that the burden is on them to show where
that.
The 68 ends up. But the 55-45 split is when the two men shared the risk, when the two men shared the work.
I understand.
55 has nothing to do with tomorrow's profits.
But the statute requires you to show the profits that were attributable to the use of the money. So if you look at it like a loan from a bank, all right, and you try to work that into the calculation of what the business is doing with it, vis-a-vis other assets the business
has at the date of dissolution and develops as the business is ongoing. It seems to me it's a moving number, but maybe not.
The 68, first of all, is always set.
That's right, but its relationship to what the total assets of the business are should move if the business is successful.
The first year, the $68,000 would generate, let's say, 10%. That would be $6,800 more.
Right.
And the second year, if it generated less than 10%, it would be a smaller.
That's what I'm saying. Somebody's got to follow it, so it's a moving.
Why would it generate less than 10%? Because the total profits would have been lower that year, or there were more assets in the business.
Assuming
Justice
that.
Justice Rogensack is saying there'd be more assets in the business.
Or less.
So $68,000 would be not half of the value of the business, or 55%, but would be 70% because it went down.
It can be like my 401k, which this last few weeks has lost substantially.
Right.
My profits vanished in 2007.
And so you want a calculation of that?
Yes.
Right.
And that was not done here?
It was not done here.
So you're not asking us to calculate.
Absolutely
you're
not.
You're asking us to remand for a new trial to recalculate the profits attributable to the use of this $68,000 and to ask the petitioners to pay interest on the judgment. And that is to reverse the trial court's order asking you to pay interest on the judgment.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hurdle?
Would you clarify all this?
I'll try to. Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, may please the Court. I'm Charles Hurdle. As the Court has already indicated, at my left at counsel table is Dan Pozanski. And also present in the chambers here today is Marie Mattson, the personal representative of the estate of James Mattson. I'd like to start out. I was at the trial. I was a trial counsel, as distinguished from Mr. Morgan here. And there's some facts that I think the Court needs to consider in reaching its decision that haven't come to light thus far.
Can I just ask you, are you going to handle some issues and Mr. Pozanski others?
Yes, I'm sorry. Mr. Pozanski.
Tell us that it may forestall questions.
Mr. Pozanski will address the post-judgment interest issue. I shall address the partnership issue.
All right.
On May 31 of 2001, James Mattson retired from a business known as Mattson Communications. That business was operating in the Fond du Lac, Wisconsin area for a period of approximately 50 years prior to the date of retirement. And it was quite a profitable business operation. Now, on that day, James Mattson did Robert Mattson an enormous favor. What did he do? He had the option on that day to make a decision that the entire partnership was to be terminated, that the affairs of the partnership were to be wound up, that the business was to be shut down, assets liquidated, and monies that were generated to the time everything was over with distributed between the partners. He didn't do that. Instead, what he did was he exercised the right that he had. And what was that? He had the right to permit the business to continue. This profitable business was permitted to continue. And so from that day forward, Robert Mattson utilized and conducted his business under the name of Mattson Communications. They had the same vendors, the same customers. He utilized all of the equipment. He utilized all of the cash, the accounts receivable. He utilized all of the goodwill that business had generated in 50 years' time. And he did not, and I think it's important that the Court take note of the assets that he was able to utilize. Mr. Morgan, in his arguments, has said, well, at the time of he retired, James Mattson's interest in the partnership was $68,000 and a few cents. Well, that was the value as calculated in his capital account. That number did not take into account whatever value there was associated with his business for goodwill, et cetera, et cetera. And this court, or the Court of Appeals, has recognized that that is the underlying policy and of the statute 138.37. That statute doesn't say that you're entitled to profits on cash that you leave in the partnership until you're paid out. It's profits arising from the interest of the departing partner in assets that remain in the business when he leaves.
Counsel, for purposes of this question, let's assume that I accept your argument that a 55-45 split is appropriate with respect to profits attributable to the use of the retired or deceased partner's right in the property of the dissolved partnership. As I read Lange and Gall and how those cases might apply to this fact situation, where in the circuit court did the court calculate out what the surviving partner's role was in obtaining new profits? In other words, his actions in bringing new business in, bringing new profits in, that would be separated out from just applying a straight 55% to the gross profits that were obtained during that time period.
I believe what he took into account was not any services at all that were provided to the partnership by James Mattson, the departing partner. Once May 31, 2001 came and went, he was out of that partnership. He added no labor or value to the partnership from that point forward. But what the court recognized at the trial court level was that the business going forward was essentially the same business as before James Mattson retired.
But that's not technically correct, because you don't have both partners giving to the business. They're not both out there doing the work of the partnership. You only have one partner that's doing the work. So if you've only got one partner that's doing the work, and even if I accept that, okay, you've got $68,000 out here, and you're entitled to profits that are based on that $68,000, and let's say you're entitled to it at a 55% rate, somewhere in there, doesn't there have to be a calculation that the other partner has given to this partnership that which the deceased partner or the estate has not, and that has to be factored into the amount? In other words, it has to be a net calculation as opposed to a gross calculation of profits.
Yes, exactly. At the Court of Appeals level in this case, the Court of Appeals recognized that you calculate the profits attributable to this business, and then you deduct from it Mr. Robert Mattson's, you calculate the value of his substantial labor and management services. So the calculation is done of profits to begin with, then you deduct out the value of the services that Robert Mattson provided, leaving a number that can be divided up. And that's what the trial court attempted to do here.
Now, how do you divide up the liability that he faces going forward, when by statute James is off the hook as soon as data distillation occurs?
I agree wholeheartedly with what Mr. Morgan indicated. Once Robert Mattson, retired and permitted a continuation, his exposure to liability for partnership debts ended.
Right.
Except for those that are already in existence.
Right. So I don't understand how you figure that in when you're just looking at raw services. He put in 8 hours a day for so many months. I can see how you can calculate that, but I'm not sure how you calculate, if I buy your example to Justice Butler, how I calculate the lack of exposure to liability, yet the, wanting a payment of the profits that result from the combination of exposure to liability and personal services.
Well, I don't think that that's part of the equation as established in Section 178.37, and it's not part of the framework as established in Lange.
Is there an exhibit that shows how the accountant came up with the $68,000?
Well, the accountant, I don't believe there was an exhibit that would specifically address that.
Just tell us, do you dispute the $68,000, or is that no longer an issue?
That was never an issue. Okay. It wasn't even an issue at trial.
So we take the $68,000.
And what concerns me about that and why I push you on that issue is I understand the dollar amount is not questioned. I had assumed that the interest of the deceased partner included goodwill of the business. But now you're telling me it didn't, which is why I asked you, is there an exhibit that tells how he got to the number? So that's where I'm going with this.
Very early on in the proceeding, in fact, in 2002, 2 or 3 months after the lawsuit was started, the court appointed an accountant, and he did an analysis merely of his capital account, James Mattson's capital account. And that was the sole basis for that calculation. It did not take into account any so-called off-balance sheet assets, meaning goodwill or otherwise.
Okay.
And I suggest to you, if the court looks at the record here, this business was very profitable.
Is there any reason under the statute why the withdrawing partner's interest shouldn't have a component of goodwill?
Well, I think it would be a no, I believe it should include it, but I think going the way it's been set up, it does take into account the issue of goodwill because you're sharing in the profits going forward.
Well, but the statute says you can just get paid interest, too. So if, in fact, the state had elected interest, they would have gotten paid the statutory rate of interest, period, okay? So if that's the choice, I mean, I didn't interpret the value of the retired or deceased partner as just a calculation of what his capital account looked like. And so that was news to me when you told me that. And I guess my question to you is there something in the statute, and I didn't look for this, so I really don't know, that requires that this amount be set by the deceased partner's capital account?
You know, in this case, I'm not sure that the statute specifically says that. The parties, by agreement, landed on that number and agreed to that number. It was never an issue at trial. That number was always accepted.
Well, could the parties have? Is it an issue here?
No.
Okay. So whether you settled for the right number or the wrong number for that account, that number is before the court. What you are fighting about, as I understand the case, is you're entitled to $68,000, but you're entitled to more than that. And everybody seems to agree to that. The question is, how do you calculate the more than between the time of May 31 and the ultimate payment date? Is that right?
Yes. Under
okay.
the framework of...
All right.
I'm sorry, but
under
the framework that was established in Section 178.37, the estate gets to choose interest or after there's been an accounting. And if you look at the Lange decision, it's very specific that there needs to be an accounting. Profits attributable to the assets that were left in the business. Now, in this case...
I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment. As I understand... your opponent's position is you're entitled to the $68,000 plus some figure, interest figure, on the $68,000. But you are not entitled to 55% of a net profit number. What's your position? What are you entitled to?
We are entitled to 55% of the profits of this particular business going forward.
From May 31 to when? To the payment?
The date it was paid out until there was an accounting, if you accept the Lange analysis, less, before that number was calculated by the accountants at trial to be $282,000. From that figure, under the Lange analysis, Robert Mattson was entitled to compensation for his services.
That was how much?
Well, that number was not, the trial court erred as the Court of Appeals identified and focused on wind-up services versus management and labor services. So we never got a number on that.
All right, but there is a number there that has to be deducted.
Yes.
How do we figure that out if you win?
Well, the amicus brief that was filed by the business section suggested a variety of factors that a court would take into account. Among them would be whether there was a salary arrangement in place or before the dissolution of the partnership, what the fair value of the remaining partners' services might be as established by in the marketplace, what could the partnership have gone out and paid for those services, and other factors that were similar.
And you want us to do that?
No, I don't. I think that's the trial court's.
So you have to. You would have this remanded also.
Right. The Court of Appeals indicated that the trial court could either conduct another evidentiary hearing on that issue, or look at what it called voluminous record that's already there. And there was testimony, expert testimony, concerning from vocational experts as to what the value of Robert Mattson's services were as remaining partner.
And after the trial court figures that out and takes it off the 280, right?
Correct.
Then you're left with a sum, right? And you want 55% of that sum?
We won 55% of that sum, yes.
Isn't that because you're still arguing that you haven't been compensated for the goodwill of the partnership as part of your partnership interest, which is the $68,000?
Yes.
Okay, then maybe you folks agreed to the wrong number, unless you can tell me why it shouldn't be in that number. Why do we want to go back and recalculate that?
The profits of the partnership going forward.
I'm talking about the 55%. You want that because you're saying that there was still goodwill in this partnership that you didn't get compensated for as part of the $68,000, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Counsel, you've just argued that underlying that as part of the calculation, you would separate out the compensation of the that should go to the surviving partner. But my question really goes towards the statute. Is it merely compensation that should be credited, or is it the profits generated by the surviving partner? You understand my question?
Yes. And I guess the statute doesn't make clear, and I would agree that to the extent that Mr. Mattson or some other continuing partner can show that his efforts resulted in profits for which the estate should not share, then we're not entitled to those.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because the statute does refer specifically to profits attributable to the use of the retired or deceased partner's right in the property. So the statute focuses on profits, not compensation. It focuses on profits. And if you have a partner that is generating profits based on the efforts that he's put into the business that is not being jointly put in by now the deceased partner, it would seem to me that focusing simply on compensation isn't focusing on what the statute requires.
I agree to that, but you're suggesting, I believe, in your question that somehow the estate is, under those circumstances, would be gaining a windfall. I think the Court of Appeals in Lang addressed that precise issue in stating that Mr. Mattson, Robert Mattson, could have paid out the estate at any time, but didn't. And the framework, which has been described somewhat as onerous, is an inducement for people such as Mr. Robert Mattson to make sure that the departing or outgoing partner gets paid out. And to this point in time, the estate has not received one nickel for its share of this profitable partnership.
May I ask, the $282,000, what is that?
Following the trial was conducted in this matter was a bifurcated one. At the end of the first trial, the court concluded that the business of the partnership had continued and that there needed to be a calculation of the profits based upon the assets of James Mattson in this particular partnership going forward. The parties, by agreement, designated a certified public accountant to do a calculation of what the profits were in this business enterprise up through a date that, you know, close to the second trial. He calculated that that number was $282,000 plus.
Okay, profits. When I think of profit, I think of some amount of money after certain critical expenses are paid, such as compensation or inventory or all, I mean, all kinds of things. Profit is something left over. Is that what profit is here?
The profit, that $282,000, constitutes the starting point. For the second part of the analysis, you have to calculate from that number or deduct from that number the value of Robert Mattson's services in continuing this particular business enterprise. That's the
Well, let me ask this. Somewhere in my notes here, I have that Robert and his wife took out $368,000. Is that just wrong, or what?
That, those were distributions that were made to him during, you know, since the time of dissolution, yes.
Well, $368,000 is more than $282,000. You can't subtract 368 from 282.
Well, it includes not only the profits, it also includes cash reserves that were within the partnership at the time of dissolution. It also includes non-expense type, non-cash expense types items like depreciation, et cetera. That was the number. The number you just read was the amount that was dispersed out to James or Robert Mattson and his spouse after the partnership was dissolved through the date of trial.
The 380 was more than compensation for services rendered. That's what you're saying.
Right. We dispute that that was reasonable compensation.
I understand that, but even if you accepted that there was some reasonable compensation in there, it's not $380,000 because there's other amounts that the partnership in effect distributed to him.
Correct.
All right.
But that is over nearly a 4 or 5 year period.
Certainly, yes.
And was the $280,000 profit over a 4 or 5 year period?
Yes, the same precise time period.
Now, the statute says, doesn't say profits. Doesn't say profits. It says profits attributable to the use of the retired partner's right in the property of the dissolved partnership. Now, I always read that to mean the $68,000. I read that statute to mean that you choose between a flat interest rate on the 68 grand, or you choose for profits that are attributable to the $68,000.
Well, the $68,000, again, and I think I need to stress it, the word in the statute is assets, and it's not just cash, and I suggest that if the focus was limited to an analysis of cash, the statute would have so said.
It says partner's interest. It doesn't say assets. It doesn't say cash. It says partner's interest.
Which is can be more than book value. Book
right.
value ordinarily does not include goodwill.
Right.
Book value includes the stated value of assets like real estate or personal property, depreciated, which may be a pittance compared to the true fair market value, right?
Yes.
So if you're doing just book value, you may not be getting the actual market value of the partner's interest in the partnership.
Can't argue with that.
Right.
That's just straight accounting. The assumption that at least some people in the court will have made, and which is we keep pressing you and your opposing counsel, is you come in with a figure 68,000 as being the value under 178.37. But then you shift grounds on us, it appears to me, when you say, well, that's not the true value of James Madison's interest in the partnership.
I'm not arguing that.
That problem?
Right, I understand. For purposes of this statute, that is the value of his partnership.
Right. And for purposes of this statute, he's entitled to a flat interest rate, or he's entitled to profits attributable to the use of the 68 grand. Where have I gone astray?
That's the precise analysis that has been recognized by the Court of Appeals in Lange and later by the Court of Appeals in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Justice Frost.
I don't want to be unfair here, but hasn't the stake been driven through goodwill value? I mean, it's 68. That's all there is. I mean, it might not be fair, but isn't that, it's all over, isn't it?
No, because the statute adds in the additional provision that the estate is entitled, again, to interest or, you know, whatever the court determines.
You can't kind of figure in goodwill as part of your base here. Or something that's going to influence that the increment past the point of dissolution.
I agree.
Chief, may I ask just definitional question?
Justice.
Under the statute, 178.37, is it your position that the definition of deceased partner's interest is something different than what is meant by the deceased partner's right in the property? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes. They're two different things.
And what's the $68,000 then?
Based upon a book value analysis, that was the calculation as arrived by the accountants.
Well, but the deceased party's interest, you're arguing that's the $68,000.
Correct.
You say that deceased party's interest is different than the deceased partner's right in the property. That's what you answered, Justice Radley.
Correct.
So I want to know where does the $68,000 fall? Deceased partner's interest or deceased partner's right in the property?
I'm not quite certain. I don't quite understand the question. What I'm saying, just maybe I'm not making this my position clear, we're entitled to the profits that were generated by the continued inclusion of the partner's assets in the business enterprise after dissolution. And that could be very little if the continuing partner pays out the estate in this instance. Or it could be quite a lot where the continuing partner resists at every juncture.
Thank you. Mr. Posansky.
May I please the court? I'm Dan Posansky. I'm from the law firm of Dempsey Williamson, Kelly and Hurdle. I do note that we probably went a little over on the time of the issues regarding the partnership issues, and I do want to underscore, though, the importance of my arguments before this court today regarding the issue of post-judgment interest. Basically, in this case, what happened was the plaintiffs in this matter, the estate, made a statutory offer for settlement under Section 807.014. In our opinion, the trial court and the Court of Appeals got it right. And they got it right from the standpoint that they said if you pay some interest into the court, it was 1 year's interest, which comes out to roughly $14,000, and you pay the amount of the judgment into the court, that we will stay the execution of the judgment. Now, this is in accord with the court's broad discretion to determine condition stays on terms it deems appropriate. That is in the statute. And I think before this court is the issue to determine what is the term until paid mean. I think it's been before this court once before in the Weber decision. Under the statutory offer of settlements provision, it says that interest at 12% shall accrue until the amount is paid. Now, this also holds true under the execution statute, which is 815.05 paren 8. It also uses the term until paid. We believe that the proper test for the Supreme Court to adopt here in this case would entail that 12% interest would accrue until the point in time when the judgment creditor actually receives the money in their hand.
Counsel, maybe I'm missing something, and please help me out. When I look at 178.37, as I understand the argument here, you have an election that you can make, whether or not you're going to take interest or whether or not you're going to take profits attributable to the use of the retired or deceased partner's right in the property. Now, if you have an election and you can take one or the other, maybe I'm missing something. How can you obtain both interest as well as profits?
Justice Butler, I think it's an appropriate question. And I guess to address that, I mean, Section 178.37 and Section 807.01, which I'm arguing here, are completely separate and distinct, and that's why Mr. Hurdle and myself made the election to argue them on separate terms here. 178.37, as I was sitting there, I was thinking this in my head over and over again. And this is when I crafted the briefs and assisted Mr. Hurdle on this and did the research. 178.37 is essentially a species of compulsion for the continuing partner to wind up the affairs in the most efficient manner that he or she can. That's why that section is there. It basically says, you can continue the business, but I want you to wind it up as fast as possible. If you take forever, which arguably may have happened in this case, then you're either going to have to pay me the interest that is accrued on the $68,000, or you're going to have to pay me the post-dissolution profits. In this case, it was $282,000, which was calculated by a court-appointed accountant who the party stipulated to it came to that number. Now, our argument is we get 55% of the $282,000. Now, that's, I think, separate because we're entitled to that, and then the post-judgment interest is a separate species. It basically says if you pay the money into the court, then we want our interest on there. We want our interest, our time value of that money. The estate has been sitting for 6-7 years now without a dime. And I think the trial court got it right here when he said, the Judge Wirtz said, put 12% in, and then the money goes into a bank in Fond du Lac County, and the bank accrues 5% interest at that time. So Robert Madison here is getting 5% interest on his investment of that money there. I calculated it. You look on CCAP, you can see how much money he's made off. It's roughly, I think, $2,300 right now. So he's making money on that money. The estate's getting nothing. So if you, the purpose of the offer of judgment statute and the policy, it's an important policy before this court that we're asked to decide, is does until paid stop the interest? And there's case law out there which says, well, you know, you pay the interest in because it compels the other party to pay the judgment in. And in my opinion, it's a red herring. I really believe that the payment of the interest in the court it doesn't compel the other person to pay. It protects their money. Because what happens is if the court doesn't stay the execution, what could happen is I, as a judgment creditor, during the pendency of the appeal, can go out and seize assets, garnish bank accounts, do whatever to collect on my judgment. So the court says, okay, put the money into the court, put it in the bank account, and it's safe. because you can't execute that.
You appealed also, so this is a little bit different than just the other guy appealing. Should that have anything to do with how we view you or your argument? I mean, you're appealing as well. You don't like the decision any better than the other side, but for different reasons.
Well, I guess we haven't cross-petitioned, Justice Rogan said. We're addressing the argument set forth by the petitioners. The petitioners, in their brief, argue that the Downey decision was correctly decided.
I must be mistaken. I'm sorry. I thought that you filed an appeal as well from the circuit court's decision.
We did. At the circuit court level, we filed a cross petition or a cross appeal at the court of appeals level.
Okay. But you're not cross appealing from the court of appeals. You're not up here as a petitioner. No.
We are not. We are here. My arguments here are responding simply to the petitioner's arguments. The petitioner argues that the Downey versus Bradley Center Corporation case is correct, which stays the interest. We're arguing that the interest should continue to accrue through the pendency of the appeal under the offer of settlement. I think the Court of Appeals are begging the Supreme Court to make a decision on this, for putting the cases on this.
Could I ask you about the offer of settlement?
Yes, sir.
On May 31st, 2001, you folks asked for $100,000. Is that right?
Pursuant to the offer of settlement?
Yeah.
I believe it was $70,000.
78?
$70,000, I believe.
I thought I saw a letter on May 31st, 2001, that asked for $100,000.
It wasn't a statutory offer.
In my file, I looked at the offer of settlement, which I have is $70,000. And obviously the judgment after the trial came out above and beyond that.
$70,000. What's the date on that?
I don't have that before me right now.
Well, that wouldn't be in our record because it's in the trial court record.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess if you wanted me to pinpoint that, I could.
I am certain that I read that there was a letter sent that calls for $100,000 as of May 31st, 2001.
And Justice Prosser, I guess my co-counsel here just informed me that there was a settlement letter that was sent out, and it did indicate $100,000.
Okay.
But it wasn't a statutory offer of settlement, right?
Oh,
offer of settlement was less.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Well, then, even if it's $70,000, the valuation on the property at the moment of dissolution was $68,000. How are you entitled to use that?
Well, Your Honor, the final settlement or the final judgment of the court not only indicates the value of the partnership interest of James Madison, but it also includes his right to the profits post dissolution, which is under 178.37. And that's where they came out. The Judge Wirtz at the trial court level came to the decision of, I believe, a judgment of roughly $119,000. It included not only the partnership interest, but the post-dissolution profits after other offsets were made. So it did come out above and beyond the statutory offer of settlement.
Well, what's the date of that?
The offer of settlement?
Yeah.
While you're looking for that, counsel, are what you're really saying is treat this like you would any other lawsuit, whatever the underlying amount is that we're awarded. If we had a statutory offer of settlement out there, we deserve to have the same consideration any other party in any other kind of lawsuit would have with respect to the statutory offer of settlement.
Correct. That is our position.
I was just trying to make that clear in my head.
I apologize, Your Honor. I brought everything I could think of here, but I can't put my finger on the...
It's, I think, February 27th, 2004 is the date set forth in the record of offer of settlement plaintiffs.
I believe that does sound right. I guess our position is, though, I guess that the offer of settlement, the final judgment came out above and beyond the statutory offer that was made, and that the Downey decision, which was decided by the Court of Appeals, should be overruled by this court. I know we're not the petitioners, but our position is that the Court of Appeals in Madison, the lower court, got it right. And they followed this decision of Judge Wirtz, who said, pay the 12% for 1 year only into the court, plus the judgment, and deposit with the financial institution in Fond du Lac County, and you get the 5% interest.
And that's why I put the 12% on right away, because there had been a year since the statutory offer, correct?
Yes. And the Court of Appeals in Madison said it takes into consideration the policy considerations of the post-judgment interest. It's both to compel the other party to pay the judgment, and the second part of it is, which is I think the most important, it gives the other party or the respondent the time value of their money. The estate here is being tied up in an appeal for several years here now, and not seeing any interest being accrued on its money. And our position is that the 12% interest accrues until paid, and the state has not seen a dime at this point, so they have not been paid. Further questions on that issue, I guess we would ask that this court we find that the Court of Appeals was correct in determining that the burden of proof is on the departing partner to prove profits attributable to the continuing use of the departing partner's assets. We also ask this court to find that the trial court and the Court of Appeals were correct in finding that 807.014 does not cease the interest upon issuance of an execution or offer of settlement. And we'd ask the court to overrule the Downey versus Bradley Center Corporation case and find that the Madison case of the Court of Appeals, or now the Supreme Court, is the law in the state of Wisconsin on post-judgment interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Moltman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may have a few problems with the lighting system, but I'll keep you advised.
I know. Thank you. And Justice Prosser, you asked about depreciation. I have to go back to or the $268,000 number, whatever it was, $360,000, that was distributed to Robert Mattson. I do, with apologies to Chief Justice Abramson, who I had, fortunately, for Tax II in law school, with apologies to her.
It's corporations, not partnerships.
No, you taught me Tax II, and I probably goofed it up then, too. Depreciation is a non-cash item, and a partnership is purely a pass-through entity, where cash and non-cash, I'll keep it simple, is distributed to the partner. The partnership itself does not pay a tax. Only the individuals do. So that amount of pass-through to him is meaningless as to cash dollar profits and the calculation of the $68,000. I will not rewrite the Court of Appeals decision, but I would change paragraphs 20, 21, and 22 of their decision.
Well, 21 deals with the issue of goodwill, which is what I was going to talk to you about. Okay.
But I would change each of those to simply say, and I think that Mr. Hurdle made a statement, unless I misheard it. He said that interest in a partnership is something that is different than the profits attributable. And if he is conceding that, which is partly part of our strong argument here, if he concedes that, therefore the 55-45, which is based solely on how you distribute the interests of the respective partners, that goes out the window based on his concession.
Counsel, is it your position that the definition of those two phrases is the same, or is it different?
Vastly different.
Okay. So it's your position that, in looking at the statute put up, which I'm quickly trying to get in front of me, that the phrase deceased party's interest is something other than deceased partner's right in the property. Is that correct? It's something
yes.
other.
So what does the $68,000 represent?
$68,000 represented his value up to,
What is it? Is it deceased partner's interest or is it deceased partner's right in the property?
It's his interest as of May 31, 2001, the date of dissolution.
Then how can you say the partner's interest in 17837 is defined differently than a partner's right in the property in the same statute? I'm really lost on this argument.
Because it 17837, as well as paragraph 7 of the Court of Appeals decision,
I don't want to know about that. I want to know about
is the recognition that you calculate two numbers for an ongoing, not completely wound up partnership. As Mr. Hurdle said, there was an option on day one for the estate or for for James Mattson to have said, I want everything wound up right now. Then you wouldn't have had ongoing profits. You would have had just a wind-up value, only a wind-up value.
Can you get 17837 out for a second?
I have.
Okay, because I'm having a lot of trouble with it. I thought I understood in it that a deceased partner's interest at the date of dissolution was whatever value you assigned to his partnership interest. And it was that interest, once determined, in a continuing business venture, that the withdrawing or deceased partner had a right to receive on that interest, either interest at the statutory rate or a part of the profits that were attributable. And I thought it was to that same interest. But if you read the statute, it says profits attributable to the use of the retired or deceased partner's right in the property. So if the right in the property is different from the deceased partner's interest at the date of dissolution, I don't know what we're doing with the $68,000.
$68,000 is the value of his interest on the date of dissolution. That $68,000 value, his interest value, is then, as I've argued, in essence a loan, because it's an ongoing partnership and they use that $68,000.
Well, let me see if I can put it differently.
I should understand.
There were two options under this statute. We could have taken the deceased partner's interest plus interest in the property with interest. That was one option.
I agree.
That would be $68,000 plus interest. Okay?
Yes.
All right. The second option is to take the deceased partner's right in the property and the profits attributable thereto.
No.
What does it say?
No, you take, he doesn't have, the deceased partner does not have a right to the future profits after
it
the
says,
date of dissolution.
It says, or at the option of the retired partner, the profits attributable to the use of the retired partner's right in the property of the dissolved partnership. So, what is the number that we're going to give to the retired partner's right in the property?
Right.
Of the dissolved partnership, which is of the as of May 31, that's $68,000.
How is that different from the partner's interest then in the same statute? I thought that was $68,000.
It is exactly that.
Well, then how can they be different?
Not, I don't know what you've just asked. He gets a profit that's attributable
I understand that,
to his $68,000.
Mr. Morgan, I'm trying again. There are two phrases in this statute which I have always viewed as the same. One phrase is the retired partner's interest at the date of dissolution. The value of his interest at the date of resolution. A second sentence is the option
doesn't talk about the deceased partner's value of his interest. It talks about right in the property of the dissolved partnership. Now, Mr. Hurdle said they are two different things. You agreed with him, right, as I understood your response. But then you seem to always come back to $68,000. The Court of Appeals in paragraph 21 says, no, you can't use $68,000 because it made no allowance for the value of goodwill. And you don't like it, 21, and I can understand why.
Well, I don't like 21 because I think it is wrong.
Right. Tell me why. Wait, just 1 second. Do we have enough tape on this, Marsha? We don't. We do. Okay, you may continue.
So the first calculation is the partner's interest in the dissolved partnership.
Right. Okay.
Let's keep that in mind because the dissolved partnership is something that is now beyond an ongoing partnership.
Right. Okay.
So you calculate that. I believe that number was calculated as $68,000.
Book value.
As his then-existing value.
Right. Okay.
And that would have included everything, including the goodwill of that partnership as of the date of dissolution.
So it wasn't book value necessarily.
No, it was not book value. It was a dollar value.
You're saying the accountant attribute, there's goodwill in that. Okay, go ahead.
Yes.
All right.
Then the second number, and I agree that I saw those words well before the oral arguments here, and I struggled for a while with them, that there is a slight difference.
Mm-hmm.
But on one hand, if you look at those words, the deceased partner's right in the property mm-hmm. in the dissolved partnership is zero, unless you give him a dollar value. So it's either zero, and I'm happy with that number, of course, but I think that's absurd. He is entitled, because we used his $68,000,
okay.
He's entitled to earn something on that, and it's either interest on it or it's figure out what it generated.
Well, apparently this Court of Appeals did not think the $68,000 included goodwill. That's paragraph 21.
I agree.
Okay. And you disagree with
I rewrote that.
You think that that fact situation, that they're wrong on facts.
I do.
Okay. Thank you.
Could you briefly comment on the statutory offer of settlement?
I'm totally confused. What has a statutory offer of settlement, which is a pre-judgment offer, got to do with the calculation of interest after a judgment is entered? To me, it has nothing. It is meaningless. It's something that has vanished. It is part of the judgment. If you have double costs, which you would have under a statutory offer of settlement where the judgment is higher than the offer, those are included in the judgment. So that's out of the picture. The only thing that's in the picture for your decision is take the simple case of Downey, which says when the judgment debtor puts full value of the judgment into the court, it's paid. That's an easy answer. And they do that as a point of law on reading the statute. If, however, you go with Scullion and the Weber case of your case, then you're into, and we win on that as well, and the reasons are obvious. We're being hurt. We have won on appeal, and our money is still tied up. Our 12% interest shouldn't be there. So we should be able to be using all of that money in our business because there's no calculation yet of how much we owe. But I think the issue is quite simple. It's take Downey. It says until it is paid is a point of law, which means you put it into the court, it is paid. If you want to change that, obviously that's an interpretation different than what's been on the books since 1994. But when it is not all put in to court, as it was true in the Weber case, as it was true in Scullion, and when there are reasons, such as an injured plaintiff who needs money. Here it's an estate. This is found money for the heirs. There's no proof that anybody needs that money. So here, all of the money, 100% of the money, was put into court. We've paid. And that's what Downey said. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Thank you, Mr. Hurdle. Thank you, Mr. Posansky, for your arguments today. And my, at first blush, appear to be a rather simple case where of dissolution of partnership and readily answered to value partners' interest is not so simple. And this concludes our hearing in 05 AP 2607, Estate of James Madison versus Robert Madison. The court will be in recess until 1:30 when it will have its third case. We are in recess.